You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So this panel concerns monetary and fiscal policy around the world. We talked this morning and this afternoon about the consequences of the crisis for the financial system and for housing. The crisis took an enormous toll on workers and created hugely high unemployment. The economy fell into recession at the end of in December 2007. So even before Lehman, the unemployment rate was rising in 2008. It ended the year at 7.3%. But the job market really went into free fall after Lehman, with job losses at a monthly pace over 500,000. And eventually, the unemployment rate rose to 10%. And the tools that were then brought into play to address that were monetary and fiscal policy, and that's what we're going to discuss in this crisis, to look at the response in the United States and also abroad and trade partners. We'll talk about how aggressively and effectively tools were used to address the contraction that was taking place and what some of the constraints were. Let me introduce the members of this panel. Jason Furman was deputy director of the NEC in 2009 and later became chair of the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House. Don Cohn is a Fed lifer who at that point served as vice chair of the Fed through 2010. Brian Sack, I believe it was 2009, became head of the open markets desk in New York, where he served until 2012. And Ted Truman is also another Fed lifer who had earlier left the Fed but was brought back during 2009 as a counselor to the Treasury Secretary to work on the international coordination side. So we're going to start off with presentation first from Jason on fiscal policy and then from Don on monetary policy. We'll bring in then the rest of the panel.
Great. Well, thanks so much. And I'm glad that on this panel we're going to get at least 20% of the people up here do fiscal policy. So inject a little bit into this room with financial and talk about some of what I talk about in the paper. The first part of the paper is just documenting what happened and when it happened. And it starts with the first stimulus that was negotiated by Secretary Paulson, signed into law in January 2008, which makes it remarkably timely. Rarely in our history do you have one that proximate to when the date of a recession was. It was done when the Fed funds rate was still 4.25%, so there was a lot of room for monetary policy. The way I think about the rationale, Hank may have a different thought, is that fiscal policy can actually be faster. Within months, the first checks or electronic payments went out to people a little bit after checks did, so it can fill in some of the gap before the monetary policy, the rate cuts were going to affect the economy. And second, that we're never quite sure about what instrument works, and with instrument uncertainty, diversifying your approach makes sense. Of course, the part of the fiscal response that got the most attention was the second part, which was the Recovery Act, signed into law by President Obama on February 17th, 2009. By then, it was clear that we needed something much more substantial. We wanted something that was as fast as possible, so we did things on the tax side in a substantial way, with the reduced withholding going into effect by April 2009. But also, we weren't too worried about things being sustained, and so there were things on the infrastructure and investment side that played out over a longer period of time. A lot of people think that after this, there was some pivot, and fiscal stimulus ended. What there was after this were a lot more fiscal stimulus proposals and a number of actions, but the actions were much more opportunistic, under the radar whenever you had a chance to. You know, there'd be an FAA bill, a defense reauthorization bill, and we'd add money for teachers. We'd add money for state fiscal relief for FMAP. We took things like the Making Work Pay tax credit, which was $60 billion a year, and replaced it with a payroll tax cut that was $110 billion a year. So when you add that next phase of a, this is about a dozen different laws, you get those gray lines there, and you get a discretionary stimulus that over a five-year period of time averaged 2% of GDP, which is the largest discretionary fiscal stimulus we've done for countercyclical purposes. And then you get the automatic stabilizers on top of that, bringing the total to 3.4% of GDP. Now, you'll see it maxes out in 2010. By 2011, the economy was still in a lot of trouble, but the fiscal support was declining. If you quantify the impact of this on the economy, the picture there spreads out a little bit more than this picture does, because a lot of things operate with a lag. In the Furbus model, for example, tax cuts matter just as much at T+2 as they do at T+1 as they do at the time you do them. And so there, the maximum impact was 3.4% of GDP. Towards the end of 2010, it stayed at about that level, but the impact on the level of output is falling starting in 2012, which means growth rates are lower than they otherwise would have been starting in that year. A lot of what we cared about wasn't just the GDP, but how it affected people. And so we designed a lot of things like expanded food stamps, expanded unemployment insurance, tax credits for families. And when you combine those with the existing safety net and the existing automatic stabilizers, you see something remarkable that I think is just very underappreciated, which is that market incomes fell across the board by about 10%, a little bit worse at the bottom because people lost jobs, and at the top because they lost their wealth. You then look at what happens after taxes and transfers, after you get the tax cuts, after you get food stamps, UI, whatever it is, and you see a radically different picture. You actually see an increase for the bottom quintile. You see most of the damage contained for the second through fourth, and you see relatively little change for the highest quintile. These are straight out of the CBO numbers. You can do it a lot of different ways. You can tell somewhat different stories, but you get something that looks an awful lot like this. You'll need to read the paper to find out about how we considered sending everyone in this room a debit card, giving you all a temporary tax holiday, and then something we publicly proposed but didn't get done, a new jobs tax credit. What I'll end on is the six lessons that I derived from this experience. The first is fiscal stimulus can be very effective, especially when you're at the zero lower bound. There's a ton of research that's been done in the last decade, some of it off the Recovery Act, and it finds, if anything, higher multipliers than we previously thought. That's number one. Number two, be very careful about state and local moving in the opposite direction from what you're trying to do federally. State and local cutbacks took 0.6% off the annualized growth rate compared to the pattern of their spending in previous recessions. Third, the fiscal system can tire of stimulus early. One of the political judgments we made was if things are worse than we expect, we can always get more. We didn't get nearly as much as we would have liked. And so building in more triggers and automatic stabilizers up front, rather than relying on the gravity of the situation to persuade people to come back, would be helpful next time. Fourth, having program integrity, avoiding the types of scandals that we largely, almost entirely avoided, is important. Fifth, that there's increased body of evidence that tax cuts may actually be more effective in terms of multipliers than spending. I'd want to see more data before I was 100% sure, but I certainly think that more than I thought a decade ago. The evidence on temporary business tax incentives like bonus depreciation is particularly strong, as it is for low-income tax cuts. And then finally, most of our stimulus was focused on maximizing GDP. You can also take steps that maximize the number of jobs per unit of GDP. So something like a new jobs tax credit, our estimate was it would cost about $20,000 per new job, as opposed to more than $100,000 per new job from just trying to raise GDP, which is what most of our approaches did. So hopefully next time we can do more, even if we can't control the downturn, to control the impact it has on labor markets. Thank you.
So I'll cover the monetary policy. This work is jointly with Brian, who's sitting next to me and clean up any messes I leave behind here. So I think as Brian and I looked at the monetary policy process through the crisis, three things, themes struck us, and they're quite related to themes we've heard before today. One was the difficulty of forecasting not only what would happen to the financial markets, but even when you knew what was going to happen to the financial markets, what would the effects be on the economy? The second one was the faster one that's come up in several themes, how even given the forecasts, with the Federal Reserve and the FOMC was incredibly innovative and aggressive in its monetary policy, both interest rates and purchases and forward guidance. But given the forecast, it might not, with 2020 hindsight, you want to ask, could it have been more aggressive? Could it have done more, and why didn't it do more sooner? And then the final one is the importance of communication. So let's start with the forecast. We were constantly under-predicting not only what would happen to the difficulties in financial markets, but the sensitivity to the economy of what was happening in financial markets. It's not surprising. None of us had had any experience with anything like this. Ben had the advantage of having studied the Depression, so he was way ahead of the rest of us. But in general, we hadn't lived through this kind of thing. And our models and our mindset, I think, was not prepared for what we were about to, what we were going through. The models themselves had a few key financial variables, interest rates, asset prices. There was no complexity, no financial frictions, no availability constraints. And I think those models reflected the way we as economists thought about the financial markets and the transmission of financial information to the economy. They are linear relationships extrapolated from a period, particularly the Great Moderation, that which everything was very smooth. So I think the lessons from this are ones that happily the FOMC, with Ben and Janet and Nellie and Andreas, have learned. That is, you have got to, it's not only for financial stability, lender of last resort stuff, but for monetary policy, you've got to have a wide focus on financial markets. You've got to be open to the potential that things will be nonlinear, that they will happen suddenly, that there will be channels of effects like credit availability onto the economy that you haven't anticipated before. You've got to probe for tail events and what their effects might be. You've got to be ready to throw out your models when things happen that aren't incorporated in those models. And I think we see in the minutes every quarter there's a briefing of the FOMC on financial developments. It's very wide. It's not just focused on banks. It's the whole thing. So the important lesson here is don't back away. Keep working on trying to understand the financial system. On the policy response, thinking about two things, the federal funds rate from August of 2007 until August of 2008, we had cut the funds rate very sharply, particularly in January, March and April of 2008. But we were just keeping up with the effects of the forecast reductions. So the forecast that the FOMC and the staff had through this period had the unemployment rate staying around the full employment and inflation staying around 2%, but there was no risk management. We weren't getting ahead of the thing. We were just kind of keeping pace with the deteriorating situation to keep our forecast in line with the FOMC's dual mandate. And I think the lessons, I mean, the question is why not, why didn't we do more? In the case of the federal funds rate, part of the problem was the incoming data. So inflation was rising and the economy was not really going into a deep recession. It was soft, but not going to a deep recession. And the lesson for us is risk management. So you're in a financial problem, the risks to the economy are to the downside, and the risks to not doing enough are to the downside, especially if you're near the zero lower bound or the effective lower bound. So I think for the next FOMC that's in this situation, taking a little bit of insurance out or a lot of insurance, even as you're cutting the funds rate, being aggressive in that regard is very important. And I think given the experience in Europe, thinking about what the effective lower bound is, whether you couldn't go into negative territory, they should also be doing that. On QE, on LSAPs, so large scale asset purchases, the Fed, we started that in December of 08 and expanded it greatly in March of 09. We didn't think that the amount of purchases we were doing would be enough to put the economy back at full employment and keep inflation at 2%. So we were behind the curve there. And we were behind the curve because we saw the costs and benefits of additional large-scale asset purchases as approximately balanced. And I think the lesson that Brian and I would draw from what we've learned since is that the costs and benefits weren't balanced, that there were definite benefits, that large-scale asset purchases, QE, can lower interest rates even in well-functioning markets. I think the evidence is pretty convincing on that. It's somewhat disputable, but I think the balance of evidence is that there are benefits to these purchases. And the costs were perhaps less than we had feared, in part because of actions the FOMC had taken. So, for example, there was a lot of noise outside the Federal Reserve about inflation potential. I think inside the Fed, we weren't very worried about the monetary base causing inflation, but that certainly was an invalid. There was no cost, no inflation cost. Inflation was too low, not too high, and it hasn't come up. So that was not worried about. I think exit preoccupied us a lot. Given this large balance sheet, could we raise interest rates when we, the FOMC, needed to do it, wanted to do it? Would it impede our ability to tighten policy? I think the work of the FOMC, the New York Fed, to develop develop tools to absorb reserves or to raise interest rates, the interest on excess reserves that the Congress has given the Federal Reserve, we've seen over the last couple of years, the Fed has been able to raise rates even though the balance sheet is very large. So I think a number of the costs that preoccupied the FOMC turned out to be less serious than people thought at the time. So I think a lesson we draw from this also is you can be more aggressive. Given what we know now, you could be a bit more aggressive in the next thing. And the final point is about communications. Two aspects here. One is forward guidance. It's really, really important that the public and the markets understand that you're going to keep interest rates low for a long time till the recovery is well established and your targets are in view. And conveying this, the FOMC's language changed over time about how to convey this. There were vague words used, there were dates used, there were thresholds used. Some combination of all that. The threshold stuff was a good invention, but it's so important for the effectiveness of monetary policy that people understand that the reaction function of the Open Market Committee has changed in a situation like this, and they're not going to get an increase in interest rates as soon as the economy begins to pick up. And the second part of communication, I think it's one that affects all these programs, is I don't think we, and that's a very broad we, including almost everybody in this room, really did as good a job as we could have explaining to the public of what we were doing and why we were doing it. And I think Ben, in that 60 Minutes program, really was an important innovation from the Fed's perspective, reaching out to a broader audience. I think we should have done more of it. All of us should have done more of it, trying to explain why what we were doing was for the benefit of the economy, not for the benefit of the banks or the bankers. And that's, I think, a lesson for all the programs we've examined today. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to come back and drill down a little bit more on fiscal and monetary policy. But before we do that, I'd like to ask Ted to talk a little bit about globally, how would you evaluate the fiscal and monetary policy response, and to what extent do you think coordination among countries on policies was effective, and was it something you saw as necessary?
Right. That's a big set of questions, Janet. I should say in advance that among the lieutenants, I was a retired lieutenant. And fortunately or unfortunately, Tim's secretary had my phone number, though I went to work with him March of 2009. So I'm a bit of an interloper in terms of the veterans of this this experience. My sense is that, but I studied it during the period and in connection with this very interesting project, my sense is that we didn't do the global policy community did not do a terrific job in sort of achieving early on a shared diagnosis of what's going on, and therefore having a shared diagnosis of how collectively we should act. On the monetary policy side, leaving aside whether we for the Federal Reserve, should have done more sooner. And I think Don has laid out the case where you could certainly say we could have done more sooner in retrospect if we knew everything we know now. But the other central banks, major central banks, were much slower in general, and some of them took quite a long time for that, partly because of philosophical reasons. One important question, probably off your topic to Janet, but is, as was already referred to, inflation was pretty high in some countries, and for those central banks who had at that time had inflation targets, which were headline inflation targets, they were worried about pressing up against those inflation targets, and that led them to delay. So it took, it seems to me, really starting in August of 2007 until the fall of 2008 before Ben and Tim and others got the central banks on the same, roughly on the same page. It seems to me it was even more complicated on the fiscal side, as I read it. We say in our paper, which you guys haven't seen yet, but we say in our paper is that it actually was the International Monetary Fund who came out with the initial idea in November, early December, about a coordinated fiscal expansion. The administration sort of picked up on that. That became a huge debate, as not just in this country, but a huge debate about sort of what counted as expansion and what's the role of automatic stabilizers and so forth and so on. And it threatened, I think, to derail the whole process. So the administration pulled back a bit on how forcefully they wanted, but they ended up getting, and certainly Gordon Brown was able to put in his London communique a fairly inflated number about how big a fiscal expansion was. So by that time, but that was talking about April 2009, you had the authorities mostly all agreeing. I should say that there was, just to be fair, there was language in that pointing in that direction in the communique that came out of the Washington G20 summit, and the Washington G20 summit in a very important way laid the predicates down for what was subsequently done. So you can't think about those two coordination exercises as separately. I think it is important. I mean, as other people have done, maybe I can say this, coming back to the Treasury Department in March of 2009, I was impressed by what was essentially on the international side a core of dedicated public servants, since there wasn't anybody else of a political appointee at that point. And the work that they put into and the dedication that they showed was and the imagination they had already showed in working on the Washington summit and the hard work that they did on the London summit was something that was very impressive and to this day warms the cockles of my heart.
Brian, so let me come back and ask you a little bit about monetary policy and start with forward guidance. And I wonder, Don talked a little bit about evolving forms of forward guidance, but I wonder if you'd reflect a little bit about how forward guidance was used and what lessons you see coming out of that. Calendar-based forward guidance versus thresholds, were they effective? Also, it's sometimes said that the Fed's forward guidance was Delphic, meant to be a forecast and not in any way a commitment. But there's a good deal of literature that suggests that effective forward guidance needs to be Odyssean or to involve a commitment. And I wonder how you see that issue, or do you think there was any commitment element to the Fed's forward guidance?
Sure. So as Don said, I think the forward guidance worked quite well. I remember, first there was the qualitative guidance that came in December 08 and March 2009. But later on, when the FOMC moved to calendar-based guidance and eventually to threshold guidance, I remember thinking about this in real time when the first set of calendar guidance was proposed. And, you know, market expectations were pretty pushed out at that time. And so the principal policymakers asked the staff, you know, how effective would this be? And I think the answer was basically, well, you know, it'll be effective, but, you know, the market pretty much understands that you're not tightening for a while. And at least from my perspective, it actually had a bigger effect than I realized. And it had a bigger effect, I think, because even though the mode forecast was tightening would be relatively far off, it shaved off a meaningful part of the tail about an earlier liftoff. So as we show in the paper, the different forms of guidance really seem to affect people's perception, not just of the timing of when rates might go up, but also of the reason for why rates might go up. So this was not that the forward guidance conveyed a degree of pessimism about the economy and people just marked down their economic outlook, which was one of the major concerns. What we show in the paper was the markets actually, and the markets and the public actually took this guidance as suggesting a more aggressive policy approach by the FOMC. And by doing that, by shifting the perceived reaction function, I think that's how you get a lot more stimulus into the economy as opposed to conveying a pessimistic message. So expectations shifted quite a bit. I think that was effective. And as I said, it was about the reaction function. Now, it was not, so my impression, and the policymakers could actually answer this better than I could, but, you know, it did not go to Odyssean guidance. I mean, this was not an unconditional commitment to follow this path no matter what. This was not strongly tying the hands of the committee to follow that path. But I think by saying what the projection was, it likely raised the threshold of deviating from that path to some degree, and it likely gave the markets just clear information about the policy intentions of the committee. And I think both of those things were effective at making financial conditions more accommodative.
Don, you talked about asset purchases, and I guess the Fed purchased both Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities, some debt. Thanks, Ed. Also, some debt of the Federal Home Loan Banks. The purchases of mortgage-backed securities were controversial. There were members of the FOMC and of the public, members of Congress, who felt that this was credit allocation and the Fed should not have been involved in buying mortgage-backed securities. The Fed is essentially now committed to go back eventually to a Treasury-only portfolio. So, in the one hand, I'm interested in your comments on whether or not you think it was important to be able to buy MBS. The other related question I guess I would ask is, if you look around the world at Japan or at the European Central Bank, and you see that they're also engaged in asset purchases and they're buying a much larger range of securities, including private securities and even equities in the Japanese case, do you think it would be useful in fighting a future crisis if there was a greater ability to buy a broader range of assets?
MBS and agency securities, that purchase was very important at the time. So despite the fact that the agencies were in conservatorship and the implicit guarantee had been made explicit, those markets were disrupted. And the spreads of MBS guaranteed by the taxpayer, MBS over treasuries, had risen quite a bit. We saw that on one of the charts that someone, maybe in the initial presentation, had risen quite a bit. And the same was true to some extent for the agency debt. And here you had a crisis that was centered in and originated in the mortgage market, and it seemed really important to get that market reopened and re-going and get mortgage rates down. That would help the help households and the housing sector. So that initial those initial purchases of MBS had a huge effect on mortgage rates. I think half a point or more on mortgage rates almost immediately. And obviously that wasn't enough to stop the crash, but it must have helped to some extent and got those markets going again. I think there was a degree of discomfort on the FOMC having to do with getting the FOMC involved, even indirectly, even though there was no credit risk because it was government guaranteed in credit allocation. There was an accord that the Treasury and the Fed signed in the spring, I guess, of 2009, which talked about the roles of each institution. And one of the pieces of that was to acknowledge that credit allocation was in the fiscal authorities, not in the monetary authorities. But I think in this case, there was an overwhelming case for intervention in that particular market. Now, should the Federal Reserve have more tools in corporate and Japan, even equity prices? I think that's very, very tricky and difficult. We heard about it some already today, that in acting as lender of last resort, the Federal Reserve had at least some residual credit risk on its balance sheet. I think getting more deeply involved in more credit risk and more allocation would push us further and further into the fiscal space. I can see that it might be useful in some respects, but I'd be very concerned about going there without a lot of safeguards, including some understanding, explicit understanding through legislation about who would bear the loss, how the decisions would be made, the relative roles of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury in this. I think it'd be very, very tricky. And I think we can have most of our effect in decently functioning markets. I think you can have a lot of effect buying Treasury securities and having that feed through to other rates. And I think the academic literature is that our purchases of Treasury securities did feed through in somewhat attenuated form into corporate bonds and other, and certainly help the equity market on the way up. So that's a much better way to go about it than direct purchases.
Let me pose a question from the audience. We've now had a long period of low interest rates. The question is, are you worried that the long period of low rates are creating new bubbles, tech stocks, commercial real estate, bonds? So whoever would like to take a stab at that.
I'll start. I think you always have to be a little concerned about the financial stability implications of promising to keep rates low for long, and people with various portfolio preferences reaching for yield, as they say, and taking risks that they're not being, may not be adequately compensated for. But I think so far, yes, there are little parts of the market that look like they may be a little overextended. People often cite commercial real estate, leverage loans. These are you can find this in the Federal Reserve's monetary policy, semi-annual monetary policy report, citing these things. I think at least to date, the financial stability risks seem to be contained, and I think the way to address them is through regulatory and prudential tools. So I think we'd have financial tools to address financial stability and tools to address economic and price stability, sort of a Tinbergian world, two goals, two sets of tools. You could target the one that's most effective. Now, that doesn't mean, as Jeremy Stein has pointed out, there might be some times when the regulatory tools aren't effective because the risks are outside regulated entities, but I think, and then you would have to use monetary policy, but I think certainly a first resort is using monetary policy to get the unemployment rate and inflation where you want it, and regulatory policy to address the financial stability risks.
Let me ask another question about...
Turn the mic.
Let me ask another question about spillovers. One of the complaints about U.S. monetary policy during this period, and particularly our asset purchases, was that they had adverse spillovers to other countries, particularly emerging markets, that complained about it. And I'm maybe Ted or anyone else who'd like to take this. I wonder if you think that's a valid complaint, and if so, how the Fed should address that.
Well, I think that's a two-part question. It certainly is the case that in terms of the global economy, if we get our policies right, especially even after having gotten our policies wrong, we work hard to get our policies right, it's better, the global economy is better off. We may have... I apologize for saying we, because it wasn't I. We may have failed a little bit in making that message. I think, and this is more of an academic comment than I guess than a policy comment. I think it's well established with the modeling that I've seen since the crisis that things like the large-scale asset purchases and so forth and so on, like any other monetary policy action, which tends to maybe on the initiative push down an exchange rate, doesn't always happen, by the way, is offset by the fact that it also stimulates real demand. And so the net effect on the net exports in the current account is likely to be close to zero. That message, I think, did not come as through as clearly as it might have been. There's this complicated question, which I think we don't really have, international economists don't really have a good answer to, that to the extent that we were exporting inflation, if you want to put it that way, credit easing, that may have had adverse effects on some economies, which we don't understand. My answer to that is always, especially in the first round, right, the world economy needed it. And in general, it depends on what country you're in. and how closely you're tied to the United States about whether expansionary policy in the United States, whether it's monetary or fiscal, is good for your country or bad for your country. So, but I think that was an issue at a minimum that was not well understood and articulated around the world. Maybe we can blame the International Monetary Fund too for that. But I think it was not well understood.
Thank you. Question for Jason from the audience. Fiscal policy was helpful, but aren't you worried about today's high and climbing debt to GDP ratio?
I am worried about it. I should say I'm worried about a lot of things in the economy, and I'm not sure where this one falls on my list. I'm not, when it comes to the next recession, and we're going to have another recession, I'm far more worried that it's going to cause a political problem that will lead us to do inadequate stimulus than I think it will economically get in the way of stimulus. I think the economic evidence is increasingly a whole set of papers that stimulus is very powerful, especially when you're at the zero lower bound, that it may even reduce the debt to GDP ratio by raising the denominator GDP more than it raises the numerator debt. In those particular economic circumstances, Auerbach and Gorodchenko had a paper at Jackson Hole last summer that found no evidence that fiscal policy was less effective at high debt. In fact, if anything, more so. So I think if we're going into another recession, basically no matter what our debt to GDP ratio is, my economic message is we can't afford not to do stimulus. I'm worried it'll get in the way of that message politically.
A final question, Jason, for you from the audience. Your fifth point was that tax cuts could be more effective than direct injections of money into the economy. In light of that, how do you evaluate the Trump tax cuts? Would these be the right or wrong type of tax for stimulating the economy?
Right. I don't think the biggest problem in the U.S. economy right now is inadequate demand. I think we have a problem on the supply side. I think that's the way the tax cuts were conceived, as encouraging more investment, investment being an ingredient of productivity growth. I did an analysis for the Brookings papers with Robert Barrow, and we found very small increases in investment would result from it, relatively small increases in GDP, in part because the tax system already had lower marginal rates than appeared to be the case, in part because in some senses they're higher under this than you otherwise would have been. But I certainly don't think we need the fiscal stimulus in 2018, and even less so the tax cut has a fiscal stimulus in 2019, 2020, 2021, et cetera. So my comment was a comment about, counter-cyclical tools. Our textbooks always said the spending multipliers had a multiplier of 1 over 1 minus t, which was larger than the tax multiplier, t over 1 minus t. The empirical evidence seems to be finding that the tax multipliers may be larger. And so when you're designing a counter-cyclical package, when your problem is inadequate demand and no monetary policy, the taxes may have a bigger role than we had previously appreciated.
And our final panel is summing up a paper that's been done about what we've learned and then broaden a bit. And this will be moderated by our own Andrew Metrick, and the panelists will be Meg McConnell, Michelle Davis, Matt K. Baker, and Bill English.
I think it's on now. Okay, great. We're the last panel of the afternoon of Clearly the Best Has Been Left for Last. We are going to be very exciting, so everybody will be forced to stay awake. Let me introduce the panelists. So all the way over on the left is Meg McConnell. All of these people here had important jobs during the crisis, and you can read their bios. I thought I would just say a little something that you may not see in their bios. Meg now runs a fantastic, tremendously interesting group at the New York Fed called the Applied Critical Thinking Group, which is unique in the world in how it is, I think, doing great things to help us prepare for the next financial crisis. We make great use of their knowledge and services in our program at Yale, and they've been tremendously helpful. Please don't stop doing that, Meg. Matt Kaybaker was at Treasury the same time that I worked briefly for the government. I wasn't a lieutenant. I was a corporal or private first class or something like that. And I got a chance to work with Matt a lot, which was he's tremendously impressive. Great intuition. His first instincts were often better than my well-thought-out third and fourth instincts. It really angers me that he's such a terrific economist without having spent any of that annoying time getting a PhD. Michelle Davis had, as people know, many important jobs working in Treasury in the worst part of the crisis. People also know that she was portrayed by Cynthia Nixon in Too Big to Fail. With Cynthia Nixon moving now into government, I have confirmed with Michelle that her career in the theater will be taking off. And immediately to my left is Bill English, who is now, I am delighted to report, my colleague just down the hall from me at Yale, where he is teaching our students central banking and monetary policy. And it's been fantastic for me because he knows so many things that I don't know and wish I knew, and I can ask him questions. It's not been as great for Bill because he looks around and does not see 350 staff members who can do all of his work for him. We're going to start with Meg. Take it away. You have to press a button, I think. But which button it is, nobody knows.
Matt knows. Yep, exactly. Good first instincts. Okay, so I wanted to start with a quick, two quick disclaimers. The first is that the views I'll express are my own views, not the views of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or the Federal Reserve System. I am not on garden leave, so I probably have to be more careful than Bill was. And second, that the area that Andrew mentioned, applied critical thinking, that I'm running at the New York Fed, it kind of calls me to make another disclaimer, which is the assignment we were given was to write a paper on the interpreting the evidence from the outcomes from the responses to the crisis. And I think I just want to, you know, state the obvious, which is it's probably a little fraught to try to interpret the evidence on outcomes, both because the system is complex and the outcomes we're seeing are a product of many forces and not just the policy actions, and also because we're looking at all this through the lens of hindsight, and we probably are oversimplifying what we were understanding in real time and what was obvious and what was predictable. And the last bit of that is just that there's a tendency maybe towards outcome bias to think that the things that worked out well were good decisions and the things that worked out badly were bad decisions. And that's probably not a lesson we would want future crisis managers to take, because you don't control the outcomes. You just control the quality of the decisions. Okay, all that said, the framework that we used to look at the evidence on outcomes was to try to organize the actions into two types. What I think that Andrew and Nelly covered this, but quickly I'll just mention macro actions that are designed to support economic activity and spending. These are things like, you know, changes, countercyclical monetary policy, fiscal policy, and the measures that we looked at to see how the quality of those outcomes are real GDP, employment, bank credit. On systemic side, we talked about actions that were taken for the purpose of preserving or restoring the functioning of the financial system. We call those systemic policy actions, and those are things like liquidity provision, capital injections, debt guarantees, etc. And the measures we used here to look at indicators of outcomes were LIBOR OIS, CDS premiums of banks, and mortgage spreads. Okay, so then we also thought about the crisis in three different phases, and the first phase being from, you know, 07 to March of 08, and the conditions that people were seeing in real time really were characterized, we think, by kind of challenging but manageable. There wasn't a sense that it was a approaching any kind of catastrophic situation. The economy was slowing, and there were strains in financial markets, and I think there were concerns about undermining the efficacy of the transmission mechanism due to those strains. And so the outcomes, the policy actions that were taken during that time, if you sort of read back in real time, were around preserving or restoring the functioning of the financial markets, keeping the transmission mechanism working, as well as addressing foreclosures. So, and then from the second phase, we said from March 08 to September 08, we're characterizing as broader uncertainty and deeper concerns. And so the recession was still seen to be shallow at that time, but there was growing concern, at least in some quarters, about a negative feedback loop between what was going on in the financial sector and what was happening in the real economy. And there, I think the policy actions taken during that time were around supporting economic growth and preventing a further deterioration in market functioning while we kind of waited out this housing adjustment. And then the third phase from September 08, really middle of September 08 to the end, we're calling panic. The conditions were closer to panic. And the concern there was a depression, was an outright depression that was being sustained by a full-scale collapse in the financial system. And the types of outcomes that we were seeking to alleviate during those times were run dynamics, panic dynamics, contagion, things to sort of conquer the generalized uncertainty that was maybe crippling the functioning of the system. So the way we approached this was to look at the wide range of literature that's been done on trying to document some of the outcomes associated with the crisis responses. And I think we drew two overarching conclusions. And the first really is that that given the severity and breadth of the strains that the financial system was experiencing at that time and the scale and scope of losses and the uncertainty around how those things would play out, the outcomes on the economic front, the overall outcomes, were not as bad as you might have expected based on historical experience. If you extrapolate from the size of the shock to the system, you might have expected something more on par with the Great Depression, and that's not what happened. And so one conclusion you could draw from that, again, with the caveat of complexity and notwithstanding, is that the mix of actions taken in response to the circumstances, the escalation from more traditional policy responses to some more innovative responses that were tailored to the disruptions that were manifesting in the markets and in institutions at the time, into what I guess we would call like the definitive actions of recapitalization and debt guarantees, that progression did play a role in keeping what was a very, very severe problem in the financial system from turning into a depression. So that's one conclusion. And then I think the second broad conclusion is that how am I doing with time? I have no idea what I'm supposed to be. What's that mean?
You're fine.
Oh, good, okay. It's moving, but okay. So, I'm not really sure what the mark is. So, the second conclusion really is that even though yes, we can say that about those actions, we did have a very severe economic downturn that caused a lot of damage to a lot of households and businesses for a long period of time, and a recovery that was slow. And so things were still bad. And so we kind of grappled with, well, how do you reconcile the fact that the escalation of policy measures feels like the mix of policy measures was about right. And I think so we tried to interpret why is that? Why is it that it was still so severe? And I think, one reason would be that the conditions leading up to the crisis were also severe. There was a severe misallocation of resources in the lead up to the crisis associated with the housing bubble and the financial role of the financial markets in that. And then I think the second reason is that we speculate is that the definitive actions, the injections of capital and the use of guarantees, came only after the conditions of panic and the real kind of contagion in the financial system was well underway and was visible and without, there was no debate that this is what was going on, and that maybe by that time, the damage to the system, to future output, potentially future output outcomes had already been done, that there was a certain amount of damage baked in by the time you get to the system functioning in the way that it was that warranted finally the action on TARP, which allowed for the capital injections, and the capital injections were a complement that allowed the guarantees, the use of the FDIC authority to do the guarantees. So so our conclusion there is that maybe the timing of that was, had an impact on what was even possible by the time we got there. And so then what we did with overall in the paper was look for some kind of what our lessons learned. I had to put this in quotes because I do think everything we call lesson learned is not, generally not. So but that's what we were calling it. So the lessons we've learned. So you should prepare for what's likely. Financial crises are going to have certain characteristics, things that look, look liquid in any circumstances will be the things that turn out not to be liquid. The institutions that are well above any kind of regulatory capital ratios or well capitalized will turn out to be the ones that are not well capitalized. And the firms that are not systemic will be systemic, right? So that there's certain things are going to happen that you need to practice responding to, and you've heard that, I think, over the course of the day. The second thing is to prepare to be surprised. So I was thinking, that people in the future, when they're, another one of these conferences in 20 years or something, they'll look back on what we talked about here and, to use another Tim word, they'll think it's quaint. And I looked that up, and so it means attractively unusual or old-fashioned. So, what aren't we talking about here that's going to be the thing that is in the next crisis? And so just thinking, and this also came up earlier, how do you think about the stuff you haven't seen yet but that you could see and try to understand how you might respond? I think organizations should try to develop their capacity to adapt and learn in real time all the time and not wait for a crisis to do it. Third lesson, communicate before, during, and after a crisis. So talk to the public about what the financial system is doing, what it's supposed to do, and what kinds of principles will guide your intervention in a crisis. And fourth, just recognize that there's always going to be forces that push against early intervention, and that in real time, the things that we now look back and say they were too slow, they came too late, there were a lot of people or forces or, there was a lot of energy towards it not being too late yet. It was just right, or if not early. So recognize that it's not, that what we see with hindsight as to, how could we have not done it sooner, is not really what's going to be experienced in real time. There'll be concerns about moral hazard, concerns about signaling adverse information. There'll just be sheer uncertainty, lack of confidence that you understand what to do. All those things are going to cause you to move more slowly. And then I think the big thing for people to think about in that context is that we should look for where we've built in triggers that are too late ex post into the crisis response tools that we have now, and look for ways to maybe try to counter that bias towards inaction that I think is inevitable. And so it doesn't need to be inevitable, hopefully. Okay, so fifth one is late intervention limits the potential for good outcomes. That's the earlier point, that if once the system is disrupted, you don't get it back. You can't make up that lost ground. If you believe the financial system matters, it matters that it's disrupted for a period of time like that. The sixth is that late intervention may raise rather than lower the potential for unintended consequences. So you delay because you don't want to create moral hazard, and you delay because you don't want to signal adverse information, and then you have to go, somewhere more extreme that is more shocking to the system and maybe creates a greater sense of unfairness. So that's, I think, a thing that is a part of managing this. So seven and eight are linked. Just seven is that you do need a strong regulatory and supervisory structure to reduce the probability of a crisis and the impact of a crisis on the economy. And then eight is that a strong regulatory capital regulatory and supervisory structure is not a substitute for good crisis management, and that we shouldn't lure ourselves every time we hear ourselves, well, the system does have more capital now. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about when it's in a crisis. And so that's the quality of the system you have is not a reason not to prepare for the problem. And so those were our lessons. That's it.
Thanks very much, Mayor. Sure. I have a come down the panel here a little bit. And
thank you. Really? I need the microphone? Okay. I'm going to come down the panel a little bit and ask Matt. Matt, you came from the private sector, came and did your duty in government, and then you went back. One way to measure outcomes is the empirical way, which is what Meg has been telling, but there are other ways. And one thing I'm curious about is what do our friends and enemies in the private sector think of the job that government did? How is it talked about when the cameras aren't on? And you can tell us, and we won't tell anybody you told us.
Right. You want me to tell you what the entire private sector thinks of
Correct.
The response? Okay.
Correct. I want you to represent the private sector.
Yeah, I was asked that a lot when I was in government. There was a desire to have the private sector support a variety of things that we were announcing, and I was sort of asked to make sure they rally behind it. It turns out it's not sort of a thing. More of a, so I think there was not unanimity in how they viewed the response. I would say they probably preferred it to the alternative. And I would also say I think there's probably a longer tradition in this country of having some skepticism of government involvement in the private sector. And I think there was a belief both in 2008 and 2009 that perhaps that was changing, and there was going to be maybe more permanently a government presence, at least in the financial sector, or perhaps more broadly the auto sector comes to mind. And I think the speed at which both administrations committed to exit, I think definitely is something that I think I've heard a bunch about. And that reinforced, a tradition of having the government pull back from that involvement, which is not the case in a lot of other countries. So I think that's sort of an interesting thing that tradition actually managed to survive the crisis response.
Thank you. One outcome which.
Thank you. One outcome which we have not measured, but we don't need to measure because it is apparent, is that the public reaction to the things that were done was tremendously negative. That there's been a lot of backlash, perhaps a large change in the political systems across many countries, in part due to what was done during the crisis. And this is not unusual for history. So, Michelle, you had a hard job during the crisis of trying to help not just form the policies, but communicate them. And I wonder if there is anything that we can do in a crisis to have a better outcome in the way the public sees it afterwards.
We did some incredible interventions that were wildly viewed as un-American, as Matt said. That should be unpopular, right? We don't want that to become like, oh, yeah, let's just do that again. That would be bad. It should be very politically difficult to do some of the things that we did. So the bar needs to be high. And I think that's something really important to pass on. I mean, in these policy papers that everyone's been writing all day, and passing on to future treasuries and Fed who face these kinds of crises, we need to be very clear that winning public opinion should not be your measure of success, because that you're setting yourself up for failure. We the audiences that we needed to reach, we did, because we focused on the audiences that we needed to be with us and help us get the system restored as quickly as possible. So, and I think that is really the lesson to me, from a communications perspective, to pass on, that there were a couple of things that were absolutely critical to being able to communicate confidence, right? Because all of this was about trying to boost confidence, eliminate uncertainty, and oftentimes we were announcing policy things that were going to take some time to put together, and you needed the confidence to be there that not only that it was the right idea, but that we could actually execute it. We had that the leaders in this crisis, Hank and Ben, every time they announced something, that was there. Everybody trusted them and believed that they had come up with the right thing to do and they could make it happen. We kind of took that for granted probably at the time, but now I don't know if you should take that for granted. And then the second thing that was so foundational to being able to communicate and raise confidence was speaking with one voice. There was never light between us and the two institutions, and because you two were on the same page, and then within the within our administration, there were no voices raising doubts about what we were doing, and that also gave some certainty that when we said something, we meant it and it would happen. Those foundational pieces were really important so that when we did make all these innovative policy announcements, they were met with, oh, yeah, good. Well, we'll see. Maybe that's a little odd, but, you know, we'll give the benefit of the doubt among the people who mattered, the policymakers in Washington and around the world and financial market participants. Public opinion, it would be great, but, you know, you don't, when you're trying to put out, to Tim, use Tim's fire analogy, when you're putting out the fire, you don't have time to explain how the fire extinguisher works. We tried to talk about the banking system as the plumbing of the economy that makes all these other things happen, mortgages, jobs. But that is not going to resonate in the middle of a crisis like that.
Thank you. Meg has focused on the actions taken during the crisis at the worst time to stem the panic. And that's one important set of things, and that's what she was asked to do. But there's been a long tail of reacting to the crisis, much of it through monetary policy. And so I just will put Bill on the spot. We heard a little bit of this from Don, but you don't work for him anymore. So now you can say what you really think. In your completely unbiased view, how would you evaluate the outcomes of the monetary policy in the many years since the worst part of the crisis?
So not surprisingly, I think on the whole, monetary policy did pretty well. So I'm in agreement with Don and Brian's paper. I think the Fed in particular was a brave and effective institution in turning to unconventional policy. I think that was not obvious that those policies would be used as aggressively as they were. I think other central banks looked to the Fed to kind of lead the way on a lot of those tools, and I think those were pretty effective. I mean, as Ben Bernanke always said, the monetary policy helped. It was valuable, but it was not a panacea, and I think that's right. There's a nice paper by Engen, Laubach, and Reifschneider a few years ago where they go through and try to add up all the pieces. How much was unconventional policy worth? And they end up saying, gee, the maximum effects of the unconventional policy was something a bit less than 1.5% on the unemployment rate, something like 0.5% on the inflation rate. So this is useful, right? That's a couple million people who had jobs who wouldn't have had jobs, and inflation that is significantly closer to target. But nonetheless, not a panacea for sure. We still had a very long and kind of halting recovery. I think there were three constraints on policy. One that's discussed nicely in Don and Brian's paper is the forecasting problem. I think it was a surprise kind of how big the effects on output were. Also, just how bad the crisis got. I mean, coming in, there, as somebody said this morning, there was a lack of imagination. We really didn't understand kind of how bad things could get. And so it was hard for monetary policymakers to see how bad it was going to get and to move kind of in advance of the problems. Another constraint was just the limitations on the effectiveness of policy. Our estimates of the effectiveness of monetary policy are it's not that powerful a tool. We got to the zero bound, or more or less, and then large-scale asset purchases only work if they're really big. And so policy isn't that effective, and so I think it was hard to provide as much accommodation as we would have liked. And then the third constraint was I think the committee really was learning over time. They were learning about the effectiveness of policy, but more importantly, as Don and Brian emphasized, about the costs and risks and how risky was it to push these policies further? How big a problem were you creating for yourself later in terms of inflation, in terms of financial market functioning, in terms of financial stability, in terms of exit? And I think the committee, as a result, kind of took smaller steps to see how would it go and how comfortable would they be and how much further could they go. So a key lesson, I think, coming out of this is those risks and costs mostly didn't eventuate. I think that doesn't mean they could never do so. So you don't want to ignore them, and policymakers should think about them and monitor for them. But I hope if there's a next time, first I hope there won't be a next time, but if there's a next time, I hope that the Fed could move much more rapidly and much more aggressively to address the slowdown in the economy to provide a bigger offset.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. We did get a question from the audience, and this is a question for you, Michelle. And I think that while this question was being written, you kind of answered it. So I'm going to read the question anyway, and then I'm going to put a little addendum on the end in case you think you've answered it, because I think maybe you have. So just one frequent policy criticism involves communications policymakers did not adequately explain to the public, which is underlined twice, why they undertook measures that seemed unjust, like, for instance, bailouts, and that communication failure led to the populist anger on the right and left that gave us, among other things, our current president. Do you agree? What are the lessons learned for the next crisis? And I wanted the addendum here is something we didn't do, perhaps in an attempt to have more legitimacy, something our friend Paul Tucker tells us all the time maybe we should do, is get the president of the United States out in front of it, like FDR was, giving a big speech that explained why we were doing what we were doing, that not just the technocrats, but perhaps the elected officials. And I wonder if... did you consider doing that, trying to get that done? And you can, I realize, only answer for one of the administrations, but perhaps speculate as to whether it might have worked for the others or anyone else can. What do you think that on this question and the addendum?
Okay, that's a lot.
There you go. Well, we have at least 4 minutes, yeah. So you should be fine.
Right. Yes, it was horrible to sit and watch the news and see that every day the story would be pictures of foreclosure signs, interviewing a family that was losing their house, and then quick cut to a bunch of white guys in suits talking about putting capital into banks and that's going to fix it. I mean, it just is a complete disconnect for anybody watching television. We could have spent, well, we would have had to hire like armies of people, but we could have spent hours and hours every single day trying to walk through how the financial system works and how the capital in the bank is actually what gets out into every other part of the economy. I don't even know that if we had done that, I don't know that it even would have penetrated because we were so busy taking so many actions and everything that we were doing was news in and of itself. There was no time to even try to explain some of those things. And I love all the people who are here at this event today, and they're all brilliant, and they came up with some phenomenal solutions. But you've seen the charts that we've had up here today, would those have convinced the public? We're not, that's not the expertise of the people we hired to fix these problems. And that's a good thing. certainly there are things we could have done better. They may have made a difference around the margins. I do think, you know, both presidents probably tried to give an air cover where they could. It's very different to be announcing a big government spending program after the Great Depression to rebuild the economy than it is to announce your letting bankers keep their jobs. It's, I don't care who announces it or how many times they explain it, it will never be popular.
Thanks.
I might just add.
Go ahead, Matt.
I think it's interesting to look at other cases. So you could look at other countries which pursued different mixes of policies, and you could ask whether they had different political economy results. I'm not sure they did. I think it was sort of most of these types of actions, even if they differed on the margin, were broadly unpopular in a variety of countries. The other observation is there were institutions in the U.S. that were heavily involved in the response that emerged relatively unscathed, the FDIC being, I think, the most clear case in point, and there might be some interesting learnings about what it is about the, you know, sort of way the FDIC was set up in the 30s and then revised after the SNL crisis that allowed it as an institution to be able to do the types of things that it did and emerge as an institution with a lot of public trust.
Thank you. We have a few minutes left, and I'd like to ask one other question, and it has to do with outcomes, but it's something that we don't usually study or we don't have great empirical evidence on, but some of my business school colleagues do, and that has to do with teams and the effectiveness of teams. Matt, as I teased earlier, came from the private sector and went back out again. And as it turns out, many, many important contributors in the Paulson Treasury and the Geithner Treasury did that. Phil Swagel, who will be with us tomorrow, he's one of the authors on the project, told me early on in the crisis when I was talking to him, he was coming from an academic background, and I asked him, what are some things you learned? And he said, I learned that investment bankers are useful. He was very surprised to have learned that, but he said they can do complicated things very fast, and in a crisis, you need to do complicated things fast. Interestingly, the what I believe to be quite successful team that we had at the top of Bernanke, Geithner, and Paulson, you have one academic economist, one career public servant who had been forged in many crises, and one investment banker. And that multidisciplinary team turned out to work exceptionally well together and have a complementary set of skills. What we study often, not me, but some of my colleagues at a business school, are what makes for effective teams. And I wonder if, I'm going to put Meg on the spot, I didn't warn her at all, but I wonder if your group, your applied critical thinking group, is thinking about that at all in terms of coming up with creative solutions or being effective at implementing them, whether there's value to putting together certain types of teams, and whether there are any lessons for us in how we should be thinking about organizing our red teams for crisis fighting in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot of research. Well, actually, there's ironically really just one book that really emphasizes the value of diversity, cognitive diversity. But it is had a powerful influence, I think. It's called The Difference by Scott Page, and then he has a second book as well and also I think this book Team of Teams by Stanley McChrystal and tries to get at this need in a complex evolving problem for a diverse array of people to be weighing in and to be collaborating on solving it. That there are certain types of problems where you do want a diverse team. There are also practices that support that. I don't think it is just the diversity. I think it's the kind of norms you adopt and the way you engage with each other that are effective. And I think those were part of what went on in the crisis.
Thank you. Okay, I think I should probably turn this over for our last speech of the day. I want to thank the panel.
Well, it's been a long day and a good day, and to wrap this up, I'm just going to, first of all, give a really big thanks to Brookings, to Yale, to David Wessel, to Andrew Metrick, Nellie Lang, Deborah McCullen. You know, this came together much better than I had ever expected. In many ways, it mirrored the crisis, right? a tight deadline, a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, and guess what? It came together at the end. And in terms of the paper writers and the presenters, what really impressed me, this was a large part of the same group that worked with us on fighting the crisis. And so they know how much worse it could have been, and they're also very mindful of the heavy burden that the crisis placed on those that were less able to bear it. So to me, it's really, really meaningful that they have day jobs, they came together, they gave her their time, and I think these papers are going to be very helpful over time, and I really, really thank them. And lastly, I really want to thank Tim Geithner, who conceived this event. He's a very creative guy, and this was a creative idea. And what better way to demonstrate the teamwork and the policy continuity than to have people from two different administrations and from different agencies in the government collaborate and write a paper. And if any of you have written, and I think most of you have written something, you know it's hard enough to write something by yourself, but to write something as a team is no easy job. So on that, Deborah McClellan gets a big thanks. So, Tim, you've got to have the last word because this was your idea and it was terrific.
I want to echo but not repeat Ben and Hank's compliments and thanks to all the people who helped make this work. I was terrifically impressed by the quality of the papers. I shouldn't say surprised because you guys are talented people, but you were pretty reflective, and it was better than Ben and I thought. I hope we can leave a better body of work to help inform the choices our successors make. There's a bunch of people that are not here we should acknowledge, because this is not everybody who was really immaterial to this. You know, not here were a bunch of critically important people in the crisis, Sheila Bair among them, Larry Summers, White House staffs from both administrations, two presidents, leaders of Congress that made the decisive things ultimately possible, and the heads of the IMF and the World Bank and others in that context. So this is just a tiny fraction of the people that were really important to what happened. This is a hard thing to do. I think it's a painful thing to do for all of us. You know, we all carry the burden of the disappointments of the outcomes and the disappointments of so many others. But it's a really important thing to do because, you know, if you want to improve the chance of better outcomes, you need to look back with the wisdom of hindsight, such as it is, and with a little bit of perspective, and looking at the choices other countries made too, and ask yourself, what could you learn? I always went into my job sort of hoping that, apart from having a better arsenal of tools, that you'd have, like, in your desk drawer, the cool playbook, manual, lessons of wisdom that you could, that would express the and reflect the experience, synthesize the experience of all your predecessors, and use that to guide what you do. That doesn't exist. We did a lot of things in the crisis that will leave our successors a dramatically better playbook, and that will help improve. It will not guarantee that we provide, but will help improve the quality of outcomes. Just a last thing, I think you got to see, and in some ways we designed this as a tribute to the people that presented today. You know, you got to see a measure of the incredible integrity and thoughtfulness and depth and creativity of the people that were in these important jobs. They're a tremendously valuable asset. And, you know, this is what we were laying out a bunch of lessons from this crisis, how dangerous it is to let your regulatory system fall behind the curve of innovation and risk, how important it is to preserve the defenses you need to create against a future crisis, why you need a better arsenal of tools, more degrees of freedom in crisis, why you need better knowledge of what works. But, you know, you need people who are willing to come spend a big part of their lives in these institutions, who are talented and smart and thoughtful, willing to debate and feel their way and challenge each other. And you saw a measure of the quality of those people in these presentations today. So thanks for coming. These are presented as working drafts, preliminary draft working papers. but ultimately we'll publish them in a book, and we hope that you and others take advantage of the drafts to, you know, help us improve them, refine them, and try to answer the questions we didn't feel we answered adequately. So thanks to all of you very much.